Well, thank you, Lisa. And I would also like to thank Judy Locke and Ed Unterberg for all of the heroic work they've done this past 2 years. And for, I guess, their committee who chose me to represent the class in this speech, which sort of surprised me and caught me off guard, actually. I want to also thank President Bottoms, who is not here today, for his marvelous work for the last 22 years, and for President-elect Brian Casey, who has got a tough act to follow. But he should know that all of us are behind him and will be very supportive and look forward to his accomplishments. Thank you very much. Although I've given many, many lectures around the world, giving a 10-minute speech is extremely difficult. And to paraphrase a comment, and I forgot who made that comment, but I saw it some years ago, it takes much more effort and work to prepare a 10-minute speech than it does a one-hour lecture. And I should add, particularly when your spouse keeps editing your drafts. I generally speak about my own research, medical research in general, life before and after the Nobel Prize. And I can tell you that my life in Carol's has changed very dramatically in the last decade. And I shared some of this with many of you yesterday when I showed you the educational video that we put together. We talked about medical research and the future, where it's going. And that was a lot of fun. We have had opportunities to meet with dignitaries and bright young students and trainees all over the world. It's been quite rewarding and very, very exciting. Somehow, people have the notion that once you become a Nobel laureate, you're an expert on all conceivable topics. You find yourself advising presidents, prime ministers, governors, mayors about research parks, technology parks, healthcare programs, research programs, educational programs, and you're often invited to go to peace conferences, of all places. So it's rather interesting, and it's a real learning curve that never seems to slow down or stop. There have been, in the past 107 years, 750 Nobel laureates, and you can find these in the Nobel Foundation website, a list of all of them, their autobiographies, their Nobel lectures, any other material that they want to provide in this Nobel Museum. About 180 of those Nobel laureates are still living today. And I would say out of the 750, there probably have been about 150 or 60 Nobel laureates in the sciences. The sciences being chemistry, physics, and medicine physiology, which are combined. And what is quite remarkable, that the majority of the Nobel laureates in the sciences since World War II have been American citizens. That is pretty remarkable. Imagine that there probably have been, in the past 60 years, I would say 80 or 90 Nobel laureates in the sciences, and the lion's share of those have been American citizens. We've dominated. And why is it that we have dominated? Well, it's because the United States has invested heavily in education and in technology. In many, many countries, trainees are not allowed to question the professor. It's a Herr Professor system where what they say is dogma and the truth, and you can't question them. Now imagine being a student in a classroom where you can't question your teacher. It really restricts creativity, novel discovery, and hinders progress, in my opinion. But that's the system in most places around the world. The Rector Scholarship permitted me and many colleagues in this class and others to obtain an excellent education here at DePauw. The required liberal arts classes that we were asked to take or required to take in foreign language, English, philosophy, economics, and science permitted all of us to get a very well-rounded education in addition to pursuing our specific majors. And I believe that these elements and requirements of the DePauw curriculum prepared all of us quite well, because you can't predict where things are going in the future in lives. And there are lots of surprises as you turn corners and go this way and that way. And I think DePauw helped us in that ability to cope with those situations. Our class has numerous success stories, with classmates excelling as artists, entertainers, teachers, musicians, investment managers, doctors, scientists, and other professions. I was a little surprised to learn from the statistics that the DePauw staff prepared for me, and I asked them to give me some numbers, that only 59% of our class in our freshman year graduated. I thought that was low. I would have expected that to be much greater. 409 of our classmates finished. 85, or 21%, went on to graduate programs. 63 individuals got their doctorate degrees, 19 got medical degrees, and 31% of the class went into some public service profession that included teaching, the ministry, law enforcement, government, military, or not-for-profit organizations. 30 of the classmates became chairmen and CEOs. And probably the most important statistic is that 88% of our class survived to the 50th reunion. What DePauw also did for many of us, 27%, was to find our spouse. And I can tell you there are days I wonder if that's good or bad. But Carol and I met, we were classmates. We happened to take a biology class together. Didn't get to know each other at that point. But we met in Fort Lauderdale of our junior year. What a classic story, right? We came back from Fort Lauderdale and began to date, and a month later we were pinned. 6 months later, we were engaged, and 2 weeks after graduation, we got married. And we started popping out babies like crazy over the course of the... I would like to discuss some of the changes in our lives in the past 50 years. And just think back, how dramatic things have been in the past 50 years and what we've seen and experienced. Remember when gasoline was 30 cents a gallon? A postage stamp was 4 or 5 cents. When home appliances and your automobiles had fewer gadgets and buttons, and very few chips, if any, to go wrong for all those repair bills. How could we have survived without air conditioning, colored TV, cell phones, DVDs? The list goes on and on. Numerous advances have also occurred in medicine. Life expectancy since the mid and late 1950s has increased by 10 to 15 years. It's now up in the late 70s. It was only in the early 60s when we were students here at DePauw. Cure rates for some diseases have been quite remarkable. I remember as I finished DePauw to go to medical school, that the cure rates for most leukemias was only 10 or 20%. Today it's approaching 70, 80, even 90%. So things have changed. Mobile emergency medical units have made a huge impact on survival rates of patients with heart attacks, accidents, strokes, trauma. Fiber optics has permitted doctors to stick these tubes in every orifice of your body to get pictures of what's going on, and they can even follow it with another instrument to do the surgery through these keyhole incisions. Imagine a doctor today trying to make a diagnosis without access to CAT scans, MRIs, or angiograms. It's pretty remarkable what was done some years ago. It was prehistoric medicine is what it was. And also think of all the advances in drug therapy. Novel approaches to hypertension, diabetes, epilepsy, mental illness, cancer. In 1958, beta blockers, which many of us are taking, statins, which I suspect most of us are taking, and many antiarrhythmics and oral contraceptives, which I suspect we no longer need, were only wishful ideas. All of this advancement in technology came as a result of investments in education and technical applications. The United States invested heavily. There was a lot of rub-off and spin-off from the investment in the space program after Sputnik that benefited all sorts of areas of education and medicine. However, I'm becoming very, very concerned that we may be starting to lose the race. I'm very concerned that the U.S. is going to start slipping behind. In our era, education was considered a very critical and important mechanism to change the quality of life and the status of your lifeline and the future for your family and your children. The life expectancy curves are flattening out, and there's some evidence that they may even be decreasing a little bit in the last year or so, the first time that's ever happened in the past 100 years. Our high school graduates can't perform but at the bottom of the list of all the developed countries around the world in mathematics and science. That's pretty pitiful. We're spending more on security and defense programs than we do in education, healthcare, science. I sat in a meeting in Beijing about 2 years ago where the mayor of Beijing got up at a dinner presentation and said China is going to increase its investment in R&D from about 1% of gross domestic product to 6% within the next 6 or 7 years. Now that compares to 2% of the GDP that the U.S. spends on medical research and other research programs. And I thought for a moment, with the Chinese GMP GDP growing at 8 or 10% per year, that means in 7 years it'll double. And if they're now up to 6%, they've increased their R&D investment 10 to 14 fold. Whereas the U.S. investment is flat and in real dollars is declining. They're going to catch up with us in about 20 years. And the people who used to come from the East to train in the West are now going to go train in the East. And they're going to have the ownership of the intellectual property. They're going to dominate in technology. And you're going to be buying your drugs and medical diagnostics or whatever from Asian countries. My Rector scholarship provided me $500 a year for tuition. I waited tables at the Kappa House. I taught the anatomy and embryology labs. And during the summers, I worked usually one or sometimes two jobs. And it was possible for me to finish DePauw with no debt and no assistance from my parents. I was also fortunate in getting a scholarship to go to medical school and graduate school. It was modest, but it was possible to finish 7 years of training, another couple of years of internship and residency, and 3 years of fellowship, again, with no debt. Carol and I, during that period of time, had 5 children. We owned a little tiny small house in Bethesda. We had a good time, we had a lot of fun. The parties on weekends were lab alcohol and some orange juice or whatever, but that's what it was all about. But we had no debt. I was able to make decisions to do what I wanted to do. I could afford to go into academic medicine and research because I had no huge debt over my head to have to pay back. Today, students who finish their education, and certainly medical students, will have a debt of $150,000 to $200,000. Is it any wonder that they go into practice instead of research or teaching programs? You know, I think the expensive education that we have is going to influence career choices, obviously, and that's been going on for some time now. It's much more popular to go into business programs and money management than into teaching and all sorts of other things because you can't afford to pay back that debt. And that's going to distort, I think, our future educational programs, and I'm quite concerned about that. Now, you know, I think my Nobel colleagues would agree that if we went back in time and started today with our educational programs and career planning, that most of our Nobel laureate colleagues, and I probably know about 60 or 70, would say they couldn't do it. They probably couldn't afford it, and we would have lost them from the Nobel laureate list. And they have all contributed handsomely to technology in all sorts of ways. I think the success of our class is pretty obvious from the sizable campaign and the percentage participation. And whether you believe it or not, I'm basically an optimist. I think when you train for as long as I have before you get your first job, you've got to be an optimist, and particularly when you've got a lot of kids and grandkids. But I am concerned. And I don't think that what we're doing is irreversible. I think it can be repaired. And I do think that we've got to think about priorities. We've got to improve life expectancy even more. There's more room at the top of that curve to go up another 10 or 20 years, perhaps. And we've got to invest in education. We've got to make it more affordable. We can't just educate affluent children. There have to be opportunities, and people ought to be able to select and participate in things that are very important to society and live comfortably. Thank you very, very much.